Sabemos.
I hate this thing. I never do this. I don't know if I'm supposed to or not.
And a lot of it is just language stuff. For some reason, just folders pops up. Everybody's me deal with it.
I'm still waiting for Debbie to put Adobe back on my computer.
Yep, there it was. It's all about the money. I wish I could tell a lot of people that. That the cheapest option is not always the best option.
Between that and, well, I mean, they said I could have Fox or Adobe because I had it previously.
Yeah. Very few still have it.
It's, to me, it's just so much easier to use. My minutes, my agenda, just so I have them.
And then I get the headset too. That way, that's the one right here.
Yeah. Not P&Z. Those suckers go for a while. And I could sit here without these headphones on. Sometimes it's hard to hear.
Hear you on the broadcast point. So just want you to have it plugged in. And then I'm going to test it.
Okay.
I am currently testing the phone. Bobby, can you hear me?
me?
I do hear.
Okay, thank you.
Morning, everyone.
Gina, this is Mitch. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
How about me? Can you hear me, Gina?
Yes, I can hear you, Pat.
I just want to make sure after last quarter where I had some technical difficulties joining, I said, I'm joining 5 minutes early this time around.
I can hear you fine.
All right, great.
All right, it looks like we have a quorum, so I'm going to get started. Bobby, are you good?
Yes, I'm good.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I'd like to call the February 15th Pension Committee meeting to order. First item on the agenda is the approval of the November 16th, 2023 minutes. Were there any questions or concerns about those minutes? Hearing none, they will stand approved. Next item is public comment. Is there anybody on the line that would like to speak?
At this time, there's currently no one on the line.
There's no one on the line.
Thank you. All right, moving right along. Next item is the performance reports of the pension and OPEB funds. And again, we have Pat Wing here to give us those updates. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Gina. Good morning, everyone else. So we have the normal performance report for the Q4 and January performance update, and then we've also prepared another smaller deck to run through, really cover some of our thinking as we head into 2024 here. So with that said, let me bring up the materials here. Okay. Can everybody see that?
I cannot.
You cannot, Jeannie. No, you guys cannot see it.
I can see it.
I can see
happy.
Okay. Mitch, did you say you cannot see it?
I did say that. Do I need to do something different?
I'm not sure. It should be coming up on your screen like it is, or like it sounds to be with everyone else's. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you, if it isn't working, perhaps, Gina, I believe you probably sent out the materials. Maybe Mitch, you can open them up on your end and kind of follow along.
I've got it open. Yeah, I've got it open. Go ahead.
Okay. All right, great. Well, again, good morning, everyone. And we'll probably walk through the quarterly book a little bit more quickly than normal because we have that last deck. I want to make sure we have enough time to walk through and keep everybody on track for the remainder of their day. But we'll start where we always do in the quarterly report, just a quick discussion on the market environment. And I'm going to circle back to many of these themes that I reference here later on in our last deck to walk through as we think about 2024. But at a high level, from an economic growth perspective, really the theme and the narrative that was prevalent all of last year continued into Q4, namely that the economic data continued to come in better than expectations. So if we look at the top chart to the right here, as you know, the quarterly bars here are the actual quarterly economic growth numbers with the fully colored in bars, and then the striped bars represent economists' estimates through 2024. And I'll talk more about that in another deck. But even though we had a slight deceleration in economic growth, you can see in Q4 from Q3 here, the data did come in much better than expectations. As we went into the print, economists were expecting around 2%, and it came in around 3.3%. So really, again, throughout the year, it was this continuation of the data coming in much better than expected, really defying economists' expectations at the beginning of the year for a recession at some point in 2023, and admittedly, our expectations as well. So if we think about that and try to quantify it to some degree, you'll note in the middle of this second bullet point to the left, as far as the Wall Street Journal's economic forecasting survey, in January 2023, they surveyed 65 economists. And one of the questions they asked was, what is the probability of a recession over the next 12 months? And that average response was north of 60% here. So again, that was largely the base case scenario. But what we saw is, whether it's consumers or businesses, you know, spending much better than they anticipated despite the higher interest rate environment. And then on top of that, what we saw, and this is, I'm sure, coming as a surprise to no one, was a pretty robust, if that's the right word, spending from the federal government. So it's really interesting. If you look at this chart here to the bottom right, what we're showing here is going past the maybe 40 or 50 fiscal years for the federal government, the relationship between the deficit and the unemployment rate. So that's what each of these dots represent. So if we look at 2023, for instance, here, which is the dot right above it, we had an unemployment rate at the end of the fiscal year for the federal government, which is September 30th, below 4%, and a deficit higher than 6%. Now, the dotted line is essentially the trend line with all the dots trying to show the relationship. And what it means that if in a normal environment, if we had an unemployment rate of less than 4% and we go up to this trend line and then over to the left, history would suggest that the deficit would have been around 1%, not more than 6%. So in other words, we had 5 percentage points of additional deficit spending than history would imply. And in a 30 trillion plus economy, that's an additional $1.5 trillion, not just, you know, going into the economy, but also supporting consumers and businesses in their spending as well. Now, as far as a couple other key economic data points as it relates to inflation and short-term interest rates, you know, much like the expectations around a recession last year that didn't come to fruition, from an inflation perspective, you know, the key expectation going into 2023 was that it was going to remain relatively stubborn. But we did see a notable deceleration or disinflation, meaning that price levels didn't come down, but the rate of change did slow meaningfully. So the darker line here is the headline CPI, whereas the lighter blue line is the core CPI, excluding food and energy, where the lines represent the year-over-year change. And you can see the notable downdraft as we head through 2023. So again, inflation data coming in better than expected. And in turn, where that left us at the end of the year from an interest rate perspective, or at least an expectation for what the Fed is going to do, is this darker line is the Fed overnight policy rate over the past, you know, 15, 20 years or so. And then the dotted lines are expectations, where the green one is what the market is pricing in the Fed was likely going to do in the coming year. And then that blue line is what the Fed said their base case is. So you can see there's a little bit of a gap between the two. And at the beginning of the year, markets were expecting rate cuts of around maybe 6 to 7 in 2024. Now, a couple of them have come off the table, meaning that now the base case is around 4. And in turn, we've seen interest rates move a little bit higher. But again, you know, there's this key difference in where we sit this morning compared to a year ago, where recession, you know, didn't unfold, inflation wasn't as stubborn, interest rates are going to come down, and expectations now, as we sit here for the remainder of the year, are much more optimistic than they were a year ago, when there was largely a lot of pessimistic expectations around the economic data. So again, I'm going to circle back to that narrative in the other deck. Now, with that said, from a market perspective, gains were quite strong, particularly for traditional asset classes. So whether it be U.S., international, developed, emerging market equities, these green bars are the Q4 numbers posting fairly robust gains, particularly double-digit returns in the U.S. and non-U.S. developed. And then for the year as a whole, it was a similar cadence from a relative perspective amongst the three major equity regions, with the U.S. doing the best, up about 26%. Now, it's interesting, I saw a data point yesterday. It wasn't through year end, but through yesterday, the 1 year trailing return, and we talked about this before, for the Magnificent Seven stocks that have become sort of these media darlings, were up north of 70% over the trailing year through yesterday, where the equal weighted S&P, so in other words, the 500 stocks in that index, all at the same weight, regardless of company size, was up less than 4%. So almost 60 plus percentage points difference in the returns of, you know, a handful of stocks versus the remaining 493. And those handful of stocks did drive the bulk of the gain. So even though it was a very strong return, it was very narrow, right? We've talked about this in past meetings, meaning that only a handful of stocks really drove those market gains, which at least historically isn't necessarily indicative of a healthy market. Now, those gains largely driven by, you know, the themes around or the narratives around AI and such, also because the economic data came in much better than expected. And interest rates did come down in Q4. So you can see U.S. bonds here posting a decent gain in the quarter, with rates coming down, putting upward pressure on bond prices. Now, on the flip side, when we think about the real estate infrastructure dynamics or asset classes within the two funds, real estate continued to remain under some pressure. Clarion did outperform during the quarter, but was still negative. Well, on the flip side, infrastructure was up north of 3%, so that provided a little bit of offset to what we saw in real estate, and I'll talk more about those in just a second. The last thing I want to mention from an equity perspective, at least on a relative basis, is that, like I mentioned, there were strong gains in the U.S., but it was generally more cyclical, more volatile stocks leading the way. So what this bottom right chart is showing is really the relative performance of these various equity styles compared to the broad market. So even though they were making money in absolute terms, if the bars are below zero, it means they were underperforming. So you can see areas like low volatility, more defensive type stocks, quality stocks, both of these blue bars for Q4 were behind the broad market. So again, just indicative of the fact that kind of lower quality, more cyclical names dominated the market in Q4 from a relative perspective. And that had an impact on the equity allocation within the funds. As you know, like we've talked about in the past, the equity exposures are largely more defensive, higher quality to provide downside protection when things tend to go wrong or markets experience a downdraft. So with that said, we can jump into the results, and we'll spend more time on the pension here. The takeaways for the OPEB largely mimic my comments, so we'll just look at a couple quick pages for the OPEB after we get through the pension here. So a couple of quick things to note. We'll show the data from these qualitative notes up top, but at the end of the year, the pension was about $155.5 million. We saw a net investment change of about $11.1 million during the quarter, which translated into a return of 7.7% net of fees, about 30 basis points behind the policy index benchmark. Now, when we couple that with Q1 in the fiscal year and think about things from a fiscal year-to-date perspective, the net investment change is a little lower because Q1 in the fiscal year markets were down, not terribly so, but did experience some weakness, and we were a little bit ahead of the game in that down market. So now the pension largely in line or slightly behind by about, you know, a handful of basis points compared to that policy index benchmark. For the quarter, there were some things that were helpful for the pension relative to that policy index, namely asset allocation. So in other words, we had more funds in asset classes that did better than most, like equities, particularly U.S. equities, and we were notably underweight real estate. Also, Clarion and J.P. Morgan, as I mentioned earlier, did well relative to their respective benchmarks, but it was more than offset by a couple things. Number one, that more defensive allocation within equities that I spoke to a second ago, and within fixed income, Wilmington Trust underperformed the benchmark. Now, as far as looking ahead, I did want to mention quickly, we do have an additional IIF, so that's the J.P. Morgan Infrastructure Fund contribution set in place, likely to be called at the beginning of April. So, as I'm sure all of you remember, during our asset allocation discussion about 7-8 months ago, the committee and the council approved moving the split between real estate and infrastructure from basically 50-50 to more 30-70, with the latter being infrastructure. So right now, we're close to about a 40-60 as we continue to get money back from real estate. So we'll get to that ultimate goal here in a couple of quarters, but it is going to take a little bit more time to get there. But I wanted to bring to your attention that at least we'll be halfway there by the end of the quarter. As far as some of the takeaways at a high level, just to run through some of the cash flows here, you can see we began the quarter at about $144.3 million. There's some ancillary cash flows, but the net investment change really drove the bulk of the increase in the market value for the fund to the tune of about, you know, $11.1 or $2 million during the quarter. The fund grew, taking into account that cash flow plus the net investment change. Now, we'll talk about the returns here more shortly in just a minute, as we always do from a peer perspective. But as far as asset allocation is concerned, you know, the themes or the tilts were largely consistent to where they were at the end of Q3 heading into the year, meaning that we had a slight overweight to equities, particularly in the US. You can see here the current versus the policy, and underweight to real estate here. You can see closer to that 4% on our way to 3%, and 5.5% in infrastructure with that additional contribution going to get us up to 6% here, and we'll call it, you know, another 6 weeks or so, and an underweight to fixed income. So a lot of the themes from an asset class perspective, from a relative weighting that were in place at the beginning of the quarter, were in place at the end of the quarter. And I'll talk more about that when we get to the next deck and talk about the 2024 outlook. As far as some of the changes during the quarter, just quickly here, we did trim some equity exposure, even though we were overweight heading into the quarter and remain overweight, just given the strong run. Like I showed earlier, U.S. equities were up north of 12% during the quarter, so we did trim the allocation here. You can see to the tune of about $1.5 million. Those funds were largely reinvested back into fixed income. You can see down here the two $750,000 purchases within fixed income. So again, some slight rebalancing, but we didn't take things back to target weight, just trimming some of the gains in U.S. equities and mitigating the underweight to fixed income to some degree. As far as real estate, you can see we continue to get money back from there as we head to the new target, so a little bit north of $500,000 during the quarter. And those funds largely went into the money market fund at the Wilmington U.S. Government Money Market Fund, and we'll talk more about that, you know, why we're holding a little bit of excess cash here in just a few minutes. So with that said, just a couple other quick pages here before we get to the update. As always, you know, take a quick look from a peer perspective, namely how the fund is doing relative to other public defined benefit funds on this third party platform that we use to generate the report. So again, a lot going on the page. You do get a sense of the respective size of the universe right here where it says number of portfolios. So it's anywhere between, you know, 430 and a little north of 300 as you get further and further out, but some, you know, fairly robust universe size across those respective periods to draw some conclusions. So as far as the quarter is concerned, you can see the returns here that I referenced earlier, and then in parentheses are the ranks. So we were a little bit below the median during the quarter. Really not that surprising. From an asset allocation perspective, we are somewhat more conservative because we have that lower target to hit. From an actuarial assumed rate of return perspective, it's below sort of the average or median public fund, which is up around 7%. for the fiscal year and the 1 year, it's kind of a similar story, right? We did have sort of a mix of an up quarter more recently and a down quarter, and that's why the two are more largely in line with each other and the rankings are a little bit better, right? Remember, lower numbers here are better. But then for the 1 year, a strong gain certainly from an absolute return perspective, but about 1.5 percentage points behind the benchmark. And really what's driving that is those handful of stocks that I mentioned earlier. Again, we sort of have underweights to those areas because just from a risk management perspective, number one, they comprise about a quarter to maybe even 30% of the overall U.S. equity market. And we don't believe it's prudent to have that much of the U.S. equities in just, a handful of stocks. And number two, we're coming more concerned about their valuations, which I'll speak to here shortly. Now, all that said, when you combine a 1 year really strong and then, another year of strong in 21 and a poor year in 22, that downside protection, you really see the benefits of that relative to certainly the policy index and the peer group. So again, not surprising, at least in our opinion, the relative returns from a ranking perspective really going to depend on the market environment if things are ripping higher as opposed to a downdraft. But typically when you put the pieces together over time, that downside protection tends to pay off, at least on a relative basis, not just to the benchmark, but to other peers out there. So with that said, let me pause quickly. That wraps up my comments for the pension. I'll hit the OPEB here in just a minute before getting to the update. But as I've been going on for about 15 minutes, just want to pause to see if there are questions or comments. Okay. So just quickly on the OPEB, I'll walk through the data here on the next page. The takeaways are largely the same, just like the returns, whether what was helpful, what was a little bit of a tractor, and then we do have an additional contribution place for JP Morgan, the infrastructure manager here, as real estate's being dialed down. So from a high level for the OPEB here, you can see we began the quarter about $58.6 million, some ancillary cash flows. So all told, the fund grew by about, close to $4.5 million during the quarter. The returns, like I mentioned, for the pension ago, largely the same. Again, it's sort of the best ideas across the respective asset classes, and the asset allocation is the same. So there will be marginal differences at best for the returns, and you'll see that when we get to the peer rankings page in just a second. But did want to point out that, similar themes here as we ended the quarter, namely a little bit of an overweight to U.S. equities, underweight to real estate, a little overweight infrastructure, underweight fixed income, overweight cash. So the themes we're expressing for the pension are also coming across here in the OPEB as well. From an activity perspective, again, similar story, almost to a T, really just the numbers being different given the size difference between the two funds. So again, after markets ripped higher in Q4, we trimmed those gains slightly to the tune of about $600,000 here. The proceeds from that sale were reinvested back into fixed income. But again, as I showed earlier, we're still maintaining that overweight to U.S. equities and underweight to fixed income. We just took some chips off the table after that strong run and then it mitigated some of the underweight to fixed income. And again, like the pension, you can see the money we're getting back from Clarion. So again, as we sit here today, we're much closer to getting towards the 3% than we were, at the original target of 5%. We expect to get to that 40-60 here in a few weeks, and then ultimately to that, say, 30-70, if you will, hopefully within a quarter or two after that. And then as it relates to the peer rankings, again, I'll just spend a quick second on here because the numbers are pretty much the same as you would expect given the implementation and asset allocation. So the returns, whether it be for the quarter, fiscal, 1 year, pretty much the same across the board here with the rankings largely following suit. 3 years, similar story there. We have a little bit of rounding. I think the pension was at 5 versus 5.1 here for the OPEB. So some minor differences, and that'll just come down to, any cash flows and rebalancing along the way. So with all that said, again, I will pause here quickly before we jump into the update to see if there are any questions or comments about Q4. Okay. So let me maximize this a little bit. So there we go. Hopefully that's a little bit better, easier to see. So quarter to date, in other words, just January right now, you'd see the total fund, this is for the pension, was up about 0.5%, slightly ahead of that policy index, leaving us from a fiscal year perspective a little north of 6%, you know, more or less in line with that policy index. So even though markets were gaining ground, particularly U.S. equities during January, the themes were a little bit different within the market. So I'll highlight that, just looking a little bit deeper at a couple things. Number one, within U.S. equities, you can see slight outperformance here that was largely driven by one of the managers here. You can see Eaton Vance. They're more of a higher quality, more defensive growth manager in the SMID space, meaning small and mid caps. And you can see just during January alone, they were more than 3 percentage points ahead of the benchmark. So we can use some of these manager returns anecdotally to think about what was taking place in the market environment. I know I didn't show their Q4 numbers, but in Q4, they were behind by about 200 basis points. So we can see them recouping that. And again, using that anecdote, just knowing how they invest within that space, again, being more defensive, higher quality, easy to come to the conclusion that there was a slight shift in market leadership in the U.S. during the quarter, where those cyclical, more volatile names didn't do as well as their more high quality defensive counterparts. Similar story within global equities here. We could see a little bit of outperformance that was recouping some of what we saw in Q4. Again, given the comments I made above around U.S. equities, when we look at the makeup of these managers, Dodge and Cox and Artisan aren't necessarily more high quality managers in the respective value and growth spaces. But when we couple them with MFS here, a low volatility, more defensive manager, you can see the impact where that space was up. If we look at that by the benchmark, that was up north of 1% compared to the broad global equity market here below the asset class was basically flat. So again, sort of indicative of how the environment unfolded. The one thing I will mention within the non-US equity space, these returns offset what we saw in the global and US space from a relative perspective, a little bit of underperformance. And this is an area that we're taking a hard look at right now, really the composition or how the pieces are put together. You know, things have, you know, admittedly left a little to be desired really over the past year or two. So we're likely to make some changes here, most notably maybe nixing a manager here, Schroders, and moving that into either the index fund or making other changes. We're still debating that as a committee, but we do think some changes are forthcoming because the performance within that asset class, again, has left a little to be desired over the past 12, 18, and even maybe 24 months. As far as real estate and infrastructure is concerned, we don't have those returns yet. As you know, they're reported on a quarterly basis. You know, we would expect real estate maybe to continue to remain under a little bit of pressure, but the rate of change to slow, meaning that, you know, less negative returns, if you will. You know, we think a bottoming process is likely coming here, maybe in the second half of the year, but it's still is to be determined because within the space, notably, you know, we've had a lot of markdowns, if you will, particularly in office, but now a couple of the other sectors that really don't have those structural headwinds, think like multifamily apartments, industrials, and properties within those two buckets are coming under a little bit of pressure because of those higher rates. So when we think about valuing real estate, you certainly use comparable properties to come to those values, but you can also use a discounted cash flow approach. So if the number you're using to discount those cash flows is higher, then the present value is obviously going to be a little bit lower. So we're seeing higher rates filter into those valuations here, certainly in Q4, maybe in the first half of the year. As far as bank loans, as you all recall, this is a new asset class, you know, just at the margin. Here, just 3% of the overall fund, but Aristotle is the manager we're using here. You know, a little bit behind the benchmark during the quarter to date, just January, but now in line during the fiscal year. So this new allocation, I think the first full month was July of last year, so the beginning of the fiscal year. So it's returned about 7% over that period, so providing some decent returns. And then within fixed income, you can see here for the quarter to date, a little bit ahead. This Wilmington Trust, as I noted earlier, was a little bit behind in Q4. They recouped some of that underperformance. And then as far as the OPEB, same story, like I talked about for the pension, so I won't run through those anecdotes again. Just noting that quarter to date, like the pension, up 0.5%. slightly ahead of that policy index, and now fiscal year to date 6.1, about 10 basis points behind the 6.2 for the policy index. So with all that said, before I jump into the final deck, which will largely talk about, you know, how we're thinking about the economy and markets in 2024, I will pause once more to see if there are comments and or questions.
Pat, again, what is the reason for our over-allocation to cash?
So the over-allocation to cash, that'll be in the next deck, Gina, but largely the over-allocation number one is we believe interest rates are lower than they should be for more intermediate term debt. So if rates are too low and they rise, that'll put downward pressure on bond prices. And number two, it's not just fixed income, but we'd argue, and hopefully be able to illustrate here in just a second, that both equities and credit markets are generally overvalued. So we think having a little bit of dry powder, which is accruing interest at a more than 5% annual rate, makes sense in the environment. But I'll dig a little bit deeper in that in the next deck.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, there are no other questions, then let's do just that. So again, I will maximize this a little bit here. Hopefully easier on your computer screen. So before we get into 2024, about 7 or maybe 9 or 10 slides here, but you know, before we think about 2024, I always think it's helpful to know kind of where we've been. So over the next few slides, I'm really going to be comparing and contrasting a year ago and what the expectations were versus what they are now, as well as market pricing, meaning valuations and equities, interest rates, and credit markets, because they're very different. It's almost a 180, which we think is very important. So just quickly on 2023, we talked about this already, how recession was widely expected, but the data came in much better than expected. So what this chart is showing is, it's called the Citigroup U.S. Economic Surprise Index. And what it attempts to do is normalize how the data come in relative to expectations. So in other words, if the line is above zero, means the data are coming in better than expectations and vice versa. So if we just think about 2023, you can see, you know, the last month or so notwithstanding, even though it was still above zero, the data were consistently coming in better than expected. Again, consumer spending, business spending, much better than expected due to less interest rate sensitivity. We talked a couple meetings ago about, you know, the consumer, a lot of the debt on household balance sheets being in the form of fixed rate mortgages and not really having sensitivity to rising rates unless you obviously sell your house or refinance your mortgage. And then on the business side, a lot of corporations took advantage of low rates 2-3 years ago to extend, issue, or refinance debt at those low rates. So those two sectors, which the former consumers comprise a large portion of the economy, you know, not nearly as sensitive to those rates as history would suggest, and then coupled with the large deficit spending that I showed earlier, really driving this better than expected data. Now, as we think about things moving forward here, this is a chart we have in our market environment, but now I'll talk about expectations. So these data points in the striped bars are economists' estimates for the coming four quarters in 2024. So as we note, growth is expected to slow here. You can see the drop off kind of till the middle of the year and then a mini reacceleration, but recession is no longer the base case scenario. It's really this sort of quote unquote soft landing. So again, we're almost a 180 from where we were a year ago, where recession was expected, base case scenario. Now recession expectations are probably still a little elevated relative to history, but the base case scenario is we'll get a mini slowdown, but reacceleration, but are gonna skirt any recession. And that's illustrated in this page too, which charts that Wall Street Journal survey I spoke to earlier. Basically each quarter over the past 3 or so years, that question is, you know, what is the probability of a recession in the next 12 years? So if we even think about things moving further a little bit or further back in time, to help illustrate my point, you know, back at the end of 2021, expectations were relatively muted, and then they increased notably throughout the year. And what do we know about what happened in markets that year is equities were under a lot of pressure because again, the Fed had sort of embarked on that historic rate hiking cycle, many became concerned about the impact of that and concerned about recession. So that recession probability or that increasing probability was priced into markets, meaning that equities did poorly. Now, what do we know about, you know, the end of Q3 in 2022? That was essentially the bottom of the market when these expectations peaked and then came down quite notably throughout the year. So again, this was a big tailwind for markets last year. You could argue, and I'll show here in just a page or two, how not a full recession, but you know, a decent probability of a recession was priced into markets. And as that recession probability receded or came down over the past 12, 15 months, that was a big tailwind for equity markets and credit markets as well. Now, the other big thing, if we think about, you know, how are things different from today to last year, is around inflation. So this is a similar chart I showed in the market environment, but also shows the Fed projections. So here we're showing, again, headline, it's called PCE, it's personal consumption expenditures. This is really the data series the Fed focuses on, not the CPI. There are some nuances to them, but the trends are largely the same. So you can see that headline decelerating notably, the core, which excludes food and energy, decelerating notably, again, coming down much quicker than many were expecting, which was also positive for markets. But when we look about expectations for 2024, that's what these dashed lines are. They're essentially showing how the Fed sees inflation unfolding in 2024. So again, the expectations are maybe we don't quite get down to the 2% target, but it's going to be a relatively orderly path and continued disinflation down to that. Now, interestingly and anecdotally, for those of you that maybe saw the CPI report come out, I think it was on Tuesday, was a little bit hotter than expected, meaning inflation was higher than expectations and the market sold off quite forcefully. And it regained some of that ground yesterday, but I think it was anecdotal. The larger point I'm going to continue to make here is, you know, how the data come in relative to expectations, which are much more optimistic today, is always a big driver of markets. And the fact that the bar, we'd argue, is higher today, given more optimistic expectations, leaves us a little bit more cautious. So again, one data point don't make a trend for sure. However, again, things are supposedly or expected to continue to come down in a quite orderly fashion as it relates to inflation. And the January report, you know, just one anecdote, but we saw the market's reaction to that one data point that did not come in line with expectations. And then as short-term interest rates are concerned, I talked about this earlier, again, how rates were expected to come down notably so far. And to your question earlier, Gina, what we saw is when you think about interest rates here, say this green line, this is what the market is pricing in. Okay, so at the beginning of the year, it was around 6 to 7 rate cuts. So if those rate cut expectations are not just in a vacuum for this exercise, really, if you think about a two-year bond, for instance, what that two-year bond is at its most basic level, the yield on that is the expectations for the average short-term rate over the next 2 years. So in other words, that's why the yield curve is inverted on the front end, because investors are expecting short-term rates to come down dramatically. So as those rates, which we thought were pretty aggressive, have begun to be priced out of markets, then by definition, interest rates have to rise, which puts downward pressure on bond prices, which is exactly what we've seen, not just in January, but also February. So that overweight to cash is really coming from an underweight to fixed income, because the market, in our opinion, was really aggressive in thinking rates were coming. We thought there's no way we're going to get 6.5 to 7 rate cuts in the next 12 months. And when they didn't occur, or if they didn't occur, which it looks like they're not going to, then rates have to rise and fixed income returns would be negative. Now, from just a market perspective, as we wrap up on the next few slides here, again, we talked a lot about the economic expectations and how they're different from a year ago, right? So again, we've gone from recession to soft landing, we've gone from stubborn inflation to orderly disinflation, and from short rates being higher to massive rate cuts coming. So again, it's our job to, and admittedly, we didn't do as good of a job at this last year as we probably should have, but understand what those expectations are and how they're reflected in market pricing. So let's think about U.S. equities here for a quick second. So what this chart is showing in the darker line is the, in the header here, the forward price to earnings ratio of the U.S. equity market, meaning what is the price of the index today relative to analyst expected earnings over the next 12 months. So that's what the darker line is. The purple line here is the 20-year average. The green line here is the 10-year average. We're just showing that because valuations have been a little bit more elevated more recently. But two things to note. Number one, what we've noted here is what the valuation was when the markets bottomed at the end of Q3 and 22, which coincided with, as I showed a few slides earlier, the peak in recession expectations. So again, I think you could argue that at that point, markets were pricing in not a full-blown recession by any stretch of the imagination, but a decent probability of one. However, when those recession expectations came down, people became less concerned. That provided a big tailwind for equity markets. So just over the past 15 months, we've gone from a price to earnings ratio of 15.6 all the way up to 20.1, which is about 25% higher than the 20-year average, and we'll call it 10% higher than the 10-year average. And interestingly, when we think about, you know, all those gains from last year, from a percent change perspective, going from, you know, 16 to 20, that's about 25% increase. That's almost in line with the market return last year. So what that tells us is the price increased, but that E, right, the earnings expectations were relatively flat. So it wasn't really driven by fundamentals. It was driven by these receding recession expectations, and valuations became more expensive. So again, it's all about the expectations relative to what's priced in. And we'd argue here that the market's, you know, certainly a lot more optimistic than it was a year ago, given the data were much better last year. And in other words, if the data don't meet those lofty expectations as they are now throughout the remainder of the year, then we're likely in store for more, or excuse me, not more, but at least some volatility, which really didn't occur all that much last year, absent, you know, a 3-month span between August and October. It's really a similar story across most other markets too. If we look at high yield debt, which is really a proxy for below investment grade debt, this is another valuation measure called the option adjusted spread, or OAS, just meaning what's the additional yield or the spread of high yield bonds versus safe treasury bonds that investors are demanding to hold high yield bonds to compensate them for the higher risk of those bonds because they're below investment grade. So it oscillates over time. If it's really high, it means high yield bonds are cheap, and vice versa. So again, the narrative here, when we look at where those recession expectations peaked, you know, we were trading a little bit above average, you know, 552 versus 527. So high yield bonds, we would call, were fairly valued, or maybe just ever so slightly undervalued, much like equities were on the previous page. But this is where we are at the end of the year, you know, well below average, whereas similar to equities, which were well above average, those are the same, meaning that both, we'd argue, are mildly overvalued here, meaning that investors aren't demanding too much compensation for holding that below investment grade debt relative to treasuries as compared to history, where the average is, we'll call it 200 basis points higher. And then finally, from a rate perspective, to kind of illustrate my comments earlier, it is admittedly difficult to value interest rates. And this is somewhat of a crude interpretation. So let me just walk through what we're showing here. So the black line is the 10-year yield on the 10-year treasury yield. Just think about that as a proxy for, you know, core investment grade fixed income. And if you hold a 10-year bond, you know, you would want the yield to be above cash to compensate you for risks for holding the bond for 10 years, namely inflation risk and risk of economic growth coming in better than expected, which tends to put upward pressure on yields. So what the purple line is basically a weighted average of cash and then what you should be compensated for. Again, inflation and economic growth. So what's interesting, we all think about, you know, the great bull market starting in the early 80s, which lasted, you know, 35 years or so. The yield on 10-year, or the yield on 10-year bonds was much higher than this weighted average, right? So in other words, we were being compensated at a great level for potential inflation, for economic growth. And during this period, the whole period, all of the additional return for 10-year bonds over cash has been generated when the darker line is higher than this purple line. So what do we know about more recently, right, where fixed income returns have been bad over the past 3, 4, 5 years or so? Well, the black line and the purple line have flipped. So in other words, investors aren't being compensated for those additional risks of inflation, of economic growth. And we know that fixed income returns have been very, very poor. And as we sit here today, there's still a decent spread between the two. Now it's gone. The spread is narrowed because 10-year yields, instead of being below 3.9%, are now closer to 4 to 4.25%, meaning that, as I mentioned earlier, as yields have gone out, bond prices have come down. And this is a key reason here, really, the spread between these measures and the fact that, again, all the historical return for 10-year bonds relative to cash have been generated historically when the yield is above this measure, why we're holding, you know, more cash and less fixed income across both of the funds. And then finally, just a couple other quick pages. You know, this one's more from a portfolio perspective, and this is really important for investors of all kinds. And what it really speaks to is the relationship between equities and fixed income. Notably, you see here in the header, the rolling 2-year correlation just means how they move relative to one another. I'm oversimplifying it, but, you know, at its most basic level, that's what it means. So if this line is positive, it means, and, you know, high or more positive, it means they're tending to move in unison, whether up or down, more often than not. But investors are very accustomed to this sort of relationship here, where it's negative, meaning there's a lot of diversification between the two. You know, bonds are sort of that ballast in the portfolio, providing protection when equity markets do poorly. But more recently, again, it's been very positive, meaning we're really not getting that diversification. So in other words, when you think about having those two pieces of the puzzle, in a perfect world, they're not moving together and investors have an opportunity to kind of sell high and buy low again and again between the two of them, which can help reduce risk or add incremental return. The higher the correlation is, the more it lessens the diversification between the two asset classes. So we don't know if that is going to persist. We do know that it's crept up quite notably. We think it's largely driven by the inflation dynamics over the past couple years. But nevertheless, there is a non-material risk that instead of being deeply negative and being helpful, that it could settle out, maybe not this high, but more positive, meaning again that the diversification benefits we saw in the first two decades of the century have been mitigated by the fact that they're moving more in unison. So to wrap up kind of all these different themes here on the last page, again, economic growth last year much better than expected as inflation came down. Recession expectations have come way down and the market expects the Fed to cut rates rather notably. And when we put these pieces together in this middle bullet point, again, it's sort of the soft landing appears to be the base case scenario, but largely reflected in pricing. Again, meaning that the narrative or the consensus of this sort of very good outcome is reflected in pricing, right? Equities appear a little overvalued, credit markets, interest rates appear a little bit overvalued. So the bar is much higher than it was a year ago when things were very pessimistic and valuations were much more undemanding. So from our perspective, really thinking about this two ways. Number one, if equity markets, particularly in the US, continue to move higher, we're gonna be pretty disciplined about rebalancing. So not only did we trim some equities at the end of the year, we did it again in January after a decent run for US equities. And then finally, given this high correlation between those two asset classes, you know, overweights to those non-traditional asset classes, the bank loans, the not necessarily real estate, but the infrastructure, probably makes sense because unlike the equity fixed income relationship, they're still providing diversification to both of those asset classes, and or holding excess cash, right? Meaning additional cash above that target. So I know this is kind of a, you know, a long-winded type of overview, but always important, I think, to take a step back, and particularly at the beginning of the calendar year, talk about how we see things, not just from an expectations perspective, but what appears priced into market, because that's largely what we're trying to do, understand what the consensus is, how it's reflected in market pricing, and if it's pessimistic, then there's a lower bar for data to clear to provide a tailwind to equities like we saw last year. But if it's very optimistic, that bar is probably a little bit higher. And if the data don't come in well relative to those expectations, then we're probably in store for some volatility. And that latter description is where we think we are, certainly at the beginning of the year. And anything can happen sort of month in, month out. But for the year as a whole, we'd argue, you know, it's unlikely we see as good as a return as we did last year. If we do, then we're probably entering some sort of mania. And we're likely to see some volatility, and that's why we're holding a little bit more cash to maybe give us an opportunity to take advantage of that volatility if it does occur, because we don't want to hold, you know, more in fixed income, because that relationship with equities is much more positive than it's been, meaning if equities are under pressure, then fixed income could be under pressure at the same time. So with all of that said, you know, I appreciate you giving me a little bit more time to run through that deck. Hopefully you found it helpful. And once again, I'll pause to see if there are any questions or comments.
Pat, will you re-summarize where we're headed with infrastructure and real estate?
Yeah, of course. So, right, actually, you know what, it might be helpful to bring this back up here. So you can see right now, So we were at about
which deck and what page do?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you could see my. So it's in the update. So it was the second shorter PDF. So if you go to page two, right, under the pension, all the way to the second to last column where it says percent of portfolio, we were at 50-50, and then it was approved to go to 30-70, meaning 3% real estate, 7% infrastructure. Right now, we're slightly below 4% real estate and around 5.5% in infrastructure. So we have in line to get infrastructure up to 6% at the end of this quarter. And then as we continue to get money back from real estate, then we'll make an additional commitment to the infrastructure manager to then move to the final destination of 3 and 7. So hopefully we're there. I would not imagine it'll be before the end of the fiscal year, but certainly before the end of the calendar year. It just takes time to get money back from the real estate manager, given the environment.
Remind me how long we've been in real estate.
It's been, now I'll go back to the other deck here quickly. Let's see. It has been since the beginning of 2020, so about 3 full calendar years. And during that time, even though last year was bad for real estate, it's returned an annual rate of about 3.1%. I guess that's four calendar years. So this is actually in the first deck now on page 31.
Page 31. Okay. Very good.
If you go to the bottom half of the page where you see real estate composite in dark there, and then all the way to the right, that's the since inception column. So you have to excuse me. I said it was 3 calendar years. It's been 4 calendar years because it was the beginning of 2020. And you can see the return there has been 3.1% annualized over those 4 years.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Then to that point, the infrastructure, the same data on the infrastructure is actually below that as well. So that's been 2 calendar years now, and that's compounded at almost 10%. Any other questions or comments from the committee?
Okay, I think that is good. Thank you, Pat.
Thank you. Appreciate your time as always.
All right, all we have left is additional business, and I just want to make the comment that this is Mr. Rogers' last meeting. His term is up and he is stepping down. I am making the recommendation that his son gets appointed. But thank you so much, Mitch, for all your insight and your contribution. You were a very big, valuable asset to this committee, and you will be missed.
So it's been a pleasure to be here.
All right, time to adjourn. Can I have a motion to adjourn?
Make that motion.
Okay, a motion, Ms. Brewington. Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay, a second from Ms. Griffith. All in favor, say aye.
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 All right, we are adjourned. Thank you. Thanks, everybody.
Take care, everybody.
Yeah, see you, Mitch.